Good afternoon. I call the meeting of the Human Services Policy Committee to order. Members, please take your seat. We do have a quorum present. Our first order of business will be the approval of the minutes from Wednesday, February 14th. And I am looking for Vice Chair Frederick. Would you like to move the minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Frederick moves approval of the minutes from February 14th. Any questions or amendments? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries and the minutes are approved. Our first bill today is going to be House File 3098 from Representative Hicks. Representative Hicks, welcome to the committee and please move your bill.
Thank you so much, Chair. I move to lay my bill over for further consideration.
Representative Hicks moves to lay House File 3098 over for further to be laid over. I understand you have an author's amendment?
I do, Chair.
If you'd like to move it?
Yes, I move my A1 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape I prefer.
Okay, Representative Hicks has moved the A1 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape she would like. Are there any questions for her? Hearing none, all in favor of the author's A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is approved. So House File 3098 as amended. Representative Hicks, go ahead and introduce your bill, please.
Thank you so much, Chair and members. I come today to request the mental health pilot project for the Somali community. In our community in Rochester, we are seeing a need and we are hoping to respond to that need. And rather than speak for a community myself, I've asked members from our community to come and share some information about why this is such an important bill.
Okay, with that, I understand you have some testifiers.
I do.
The first testifier that I have on the list is Mohammed Jama. If you'd like to come forward, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. If you'd like to come down to the table, please. Yep, right there. Thank you for being here today. I appreciate you taking time to be before our committee. If you would like to, for the record, please introduce yourself and who you're with, and then please start your testimony.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Mohammed Jama. I'm Assistant Director of Rochester Medical Science Academy. Rochester Medical Science Academy has been serving the Somali community in Rochester for 19 years. Our mission is to maximize opportunity for our children through educational innovation that will ensure their full deployment as a health ambassador donors to the greatest community. Many of our students go to university and colleges and return to our community to serve our community. However, there are many challenges that are facing the Somali community in Rochester. Two biggest issues are mental health and housing, but the biggest one remain mental health. On October 1, 2019, a Somali woman attempted to kill herself and her five children by locking herself and her five children inside a car in a garage in an attempt to fill the car with exhaust. A woman was experiencing mental health. Mental health is the biggest issue that many Somali community in Rochester are facing. We have students that are missing school because of a school phobia. We have families that are experiencing mental health. And it's something they often ignore because some of them think it will go away by itself. They need some type of education to understand what they need so they can get the proper treatment. And I think that's the greatest need is to address and educate our community members. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your testimony and thank you for being here today. I will call up our next testifier, and then if the testifiers want to stay around in case there's any other questions. Our next testifier we have is Omar Noor. Executive Director, please come forward. Thank you for taking the time to be here before our committee. If you'd like to introduce yourself again, who you're with, and then please start your testimony.
Yeah, my name is Omar Noor. I'm Executive Director of Somali American Social Service Association. I would like to say that we are grateful to our representative, and we are thankful for the opportunity to address the topic that holds great significance in our community, and especially mental health. Mental health is a key aspect of well-being, but often neglected by many cultural groups. Example is Somali community, my community. The concept of the mental health is viewed as taboo. When people seeing struggling community members who is suffering from the mental health related illness, it's ignored. This result is self-harm, suffering of to other, and property damage. I would like to share with you on the data from the Front Public Health and National Laboratory and of the Medical for the common mental health disorder in Somali community. They stated that panic disorder 28%, depression 23%, PTSD 22%, anxiety 25%. So we have the case study here. We had an incident where the young Somali man was showing a sign, mental health issue. The community leaders and several people had talked with the father, whom the young man was leaving, considering professional help before his son. After several discussion, the father insisted his son did not have any mental health issue. We later found out that son violated, attacked his father, and took out his two eyes. The father died a few years later. So here our goal, understanding mental health in context immigrant, communicating positively with the impact individuals, referral to professional services. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Appreciate that. Next we have Ahmed Osman. If you'd like to come down, introduce yourself and who with you're with, and then you can start your testimony. Welcome to the committee, and thank you for taking time to be here today.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ahmed Osman. I am a program manager at IMAA, Intercultural Mutual Assistance Association in Rochester, Minnesota. Why do we push for mental health within the Somali community? My organization has been in existence for almost 40 years, helping for the resettlement of a lot of the immigrants and the refugees. We started with the Southeast Asian all the way with the latest newcomers, the Ukrainians that came into the area. But we have seen a big difference when it came to the Somali community, mental health. Myself, I'm originally from Somalia, and unfortunately, I have a lot of neighborhood friends and relatives and people that I'm acquainted that suffered from mental illness. And this has been a subject where it's very difficult to talk about. Now, when we came into the United States, it has become really clear to us that we need to talk about it and become really transparent about it. So key question is, how do you change it? The perspective of an entire community that moved into a different world. Mm-hmm. One of the cases that I was hoping that one of my friends or colleagues will present was a few years back. We had a son that actually took the eyes out of his own father, literally with his own hands. And this was a teenager that had some issues. The father passed away recently, and he used to be a friend of mine, neighbors in the village back home in the city of Mogadishu. He called me 2 weeks before that incident from Nairobi, Kenya, where he was visiting his families. And he told me, my son is having some trouble, difficulties. Can you find, there is a sheikh, the sheikh means a religious guy that knows more than us about the Quran and all that. How can he help him? The whole mental illness, the way they see it, is not as a chronic condition or something that needs a doctor's view or someone that's an expert. they believe that this is all about being possessed by a demon or something else, which unfortunately I used to believe too, that way. I mean, 30 years ago, before I moved into this country. And it's normal to view that way. But that's not the case anymore. How can we make them aware that there is light at the end of the tunnel, which means they can recover with the proper expertise and help? 7 years ago, myself and my executive director, we looked into it and we said that we need the help. At that time, DHS was very responsive and they helped us in granting a small pilot project. The same school, RMSA, that's where we looked at it. We identified 11 students, young ones, they were in the middle school. At that time, we hired an expert in DBT, where after 2 years for that program, we saw the difference that it made for those 11 kids. We cannot neglect the future. These are the youngsters. They are the future of the community. They are the future of Rochester. They are the future for Olmsted County. So we have an obligation to do whatever it takes to make them change. The proposal that we are presenting is not just to the kids, because we also find out that we cannot really make a difference if we do not involve the parents into this program. Without the parents' involvement, there is no way. How can we shift the focus of the parents making a priority in only thinking about shelter, food, and clothing? That's the only obligation they really believe. What about them being involved in the children's education, in the children's awareness, and also how they can help in changing the children's response to their emotions into a more positive emotion, I mean, instead of the negative, you know, to concentrate. So by no means I'm an expert of DBT and mental illness, but it's something that I have seen it, that I looked into it, and I think this bill can make a huge and tremendous difference, not only in the academic process, progress of these kids, but also within the community and the behavior, and how can we really, really look at a better future. Thank you for listening.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for your testimony. Next, that's all the testifiers that are signed up right now. I will ask, are there any further testifiers in the public who would like to address the committee on this issue? Not seeing any. At this time, I would turn it over to questions and comments from the members. Are there any questions or comments from any of the representatives at the table? Representative Engen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for you guys. How much will be spent of that $1.8 million on administrative costs and staffing? Do you have an estimate?
I will, Representative Hicks, so it would be Mr. Osman, would you have that answer?
I do not have the exact answer, but I believe that the practice is normally for administrative costs is in the 10% and no max, no more than 12%. Mostly is done in hiring expert professionals that can make a difference and creating that discussion, jump start that with the parents, you know, the cost will be so. But normally it's in the range of 10 to 12%.
Okay. Representative Engen.
And then the staffing?
Mr. Osman, yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah. The staffing will be there, and I'm not sure. I'm not the executive director of the program. I mean, I don't know if anyone has that answer. But normally, yes, you will have someone that will manage that program, not to mention also the school. This will be in partnership with the school and with the SASA organization. So you're looking at the three different partnerships. And I believe also NAMI of southeastern Minnesota might be also put into the picture, because previously they provided the experts, you know, for the DBT.
Okay, very good. Representative Engen, any further questions? And then I think Representative Baker was first and then Backer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm always in front of Representative Backer. Anyway, every chance.
I'm sorry, folks, right. He's lying.
Right. thank you for your testimony. This may be a question, perhaps, maybe for the executive director, but again, in my community in Wilmer, we've got, again, a large Somali population. I am actually working right now to try to establish a very specific mental health and really substance use outpatient for our community that's coming together. And they're finally, the Somali community is really coming together now because the new generations are taking in this information differently than some of the elders. They're involving more imams and trying to have this a conversation. So my question to you, either, I don't know who you want to address, who wants to address this, but looking at your website, looking at your board of directors, I don't see maybe that religious connection that I know is so important in the Somali community. Help me understand if we can ever find money for this pilot. I know it's a year more out. I know you pushed it out. But it's important because the community is really struggling with mental health. How are you addressing in Rochester this connection between the deep religion, the religion component to mental health?
Representative Hicks.
I'd like to invite Mr. Noor to come back from the Somali Social Service Agency because I think he can speak really well to some of those interconnectivities.
Executive Director Noor, welcome back. And if you'd like to go ahead.
Yeah, so I understand that you have to have a connection. We have the Somali community with the imams. So as you know, we have four mosques now in the Rochester area, and we have a good relationship, and we have the school and Saturday and Sundays. So we invite every time imams when we have a gathering for the any event is talk about the mental issue, talk about the dealing drugs for our kids. So they give that luxuries. Also, good news, we have great, you know, educators now from the, our my clinic, you know, medical doctors grow up our area from middle school, high school, medical school now. So as you know, our community, they know, they trust each other. When they come, one of the medical doctor, young man in front of them saying that mental issue is like asthma, it's not a big deal. We can solve it that when my clinic is here. That is a perfect one. So we have great connection. Or the community, you know, for the imams. So imams is the backbone of the community when it comes everything. Solution for the family connection, and this is a mental issue, education, marriage. So we are backbone for our community. We have good relationship.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Baker.
Thank you.
Next, Representative Backer, and then after that, we'll be moving on.
Okay, thank you, Chair. And they say the best for the last, I guess. That's all I have to say for Representative Baker. Anyways, a couple things. One of the things, and this is more FYI, when I went to your website, it is required under law that your EIN number would be listed. I was not able to find, because it's a nonprofit, just FYI, was not able to find that on your website. My question to you is, I looked up the tax return. Now, I know this is a couple years back, but from 2021, it shows a total revenue of $3.3 million and expenditures of $469,000. So my question is I know that's a couple years back, I get it, but where is that roughly $3 million from 2021? Where did that go? Because that's what it's showing on the recent tax statement that I could pull up online from the Internal Revenue Service.
So to me, I think that's not my organization.
Yeah, I would just like to, if someone could get back with me, because
my organization is Somali American Social Service, and our budget never increased about $200,000 a year. So we are new, we are growing right now.
Yep. I just would like to know where the money is going, because obviously we are stewards of the public treasury, and we ask these questions frequently, but where, in 2021, we had $3.3 million, $469 with the expenses, and net assets and funds on balance shows $3,053,000. So we'd just like to know how those funds, what those funds are used for and stuff like that. That's a pretty good cash revenue. That's a pretty good balance, that's all.
Representative Hicks?
Yes, thank you.
And I know you don't belong to that organization, and that might be for you, Representative Hicks, excuse me. But, yeah, so, that's what happens when you fall after Baker, okay?
So, well, I mean, it's always Baker's fault, right? So what I would say is that there's several organizations involved in this bill, and so happy to take a look at that. You know, IMMA would be the primary partner in this bill, and IMMA has been in our community for 40 years, and I would be happy to speak with their executive director further to get some more information, but they have been an excellent partner in Rochester for 40 years, and so I have no doubt that whatever your questions are can be answered by their executive director, and I'm happy to make that connection.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to imply anything. I'm just, I know our funds are limited.
Backer, excuse me.
See, you got it wrong again.
Yeah, I got that wrong again. Sorry.
I'm sorry, Chair.
Make sure to go, you got to go through the chair here, so please.
Sorry, Chair. I am pulling up the information from IMAA, and I would really like to know that because obviously we want to be good stewards of those public monies. So, and we see each other quite often during the week, so I know you'll share that with me when you get that. Thank you, Representative Hicks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we'll move back to Representative Hicks. Any closing comments, and would you like to renew your motion as amended?
Yes, I would like to renew my motion as amended. My only closing comment is that our community has, all of Minnesota has struggled with mental health, and I think certain communities have struggled in different ways. And so when we're looking for solutions, I think it's really important, like my colleague said, to look to the community to help solve those problems and not try to dictate for. And so I am just honored to bring this bill and lay it over and to just continue the conversations, because I don't think it's just Rochester's community that needs to be having these conversations. And so thank you so much, everyone.
With that, Representative Hicks moves to lay over House File 3098 as amended, and the bill is laid over. Next on the agenda is House File 3519, another representative, 34. Excuse me, 3419. Thank you. I said 35, didn't I? 3419, this is another Representative Hicks bill.
I'm just going to hang out.
Okay, I'll give you just a second there. If you'd like to move your bill when you're ready.
Yes, please. I'd like to move my bill.
Okay. Representative Hicks moves House File 3419 to be re-referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. If you'd like to go ahead and explain your bill, please.
Yes, thank you so much. So all of you had to listen to me last year, give lots of presentations on MAPD. I'm back again. Last year, we were able to remove the asset limit for medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities. For those of you that maybe are new to the committee or just hearing online for the first time, the MAPD is a program that allows people with disabilities to work and to pay a premium based on their income to access medical assistance. The formula for that premium hasn't been updated ever. It's pretty outdated. And we are seeing some significant concerns about the ability to pay those additional premiums. Also, as a reminder, people with MAPD many times carry primary insurance through their employer as well. So I just want to sort of set the stage of that history. This bill works to remove the language that would, in essence, close people's health care if they weren't able to make a payment. I've also spoken to the department, and we have some potential administrative tweaks that may help make the burden for our counties and our department a little bit easier. Right now, there's a lot of talking back and forth that have to happen to set premiums, which is administratively not necessary. So we're also going to work at hopefully bringing an author's amendment before this is heard in the next committee to also make some less work for our partners for unnecessary paperwork and finger clicking for that as well. So in essence, what this bill would do is just make sure that if you had a bad month at work, you didn't lose all of the supports to keep you on the planet and in community, so that we wouldn't end by non-payment. The department would still be able, the way that this is currently written, the department would still be able to collect via tax refunds or other mechanisms if, you know, somebody just decided not to pay ever, which I've worked with a lot of people with disabilities who are working in the community, and that is never the intent. People want to pay their bills. People want to get their health care. This is a safety net to make sure that if you're not able to pay, you don't lose your health care. So thank you so much, and I do have some testifiers who can share more of their personal stories.
Okay. Thank you. We'll proceed to the first testifier. I have Ms. Jillian Nelson. If you'd like to introduce yourself, be with and welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Fisher and committee members. I'm Jillian Nelson, the Community Resource and Policy Advocate for the Autism Society of Minnesota. Many of you know I'm an autistic adult, and I'm a recipient of medical assistance for employed people with disabilities. I want to begin by thanking you for your support last session in what was a monumental step towards reforming a program that has become the backbone of the working disability community. And I want to ask you to support House File 3419. Paul Wellstone once said, "It is the belief that extremes and excess of inequality must be reduced so that each person is free to fully develop his or her full potential." The current structure of MAEPD is built on a foundation of excess and extreme inequality, essentially charging a high tax and heavy administrative burden for the unchosen reality of being disabled. A study by the National Disability Institute in 2020 showed that people with disabilities pay over $17,000 a year more than a person without a disability just to exist. In the community, we call this a disability tax. This is the thing we pay extra for to live an accessible life, like needing a mattress that will reduce chronic pain or sensory tools or countless other things I pay more for so that they can make my world as accessible as possible. For me, one of the biggest contributions to that disability tax is my MAEPD premium. Every month I make choices. Pay my premium or pay my car payment on time. Pay my premium or buy produce. Pay my premium or pay my electric bill in full. I shouldn't have to make these choices. No one should have to make these choices. The choice, however, is quite simple. Pay my premiums. Because without them, I don't have the support I need to survive. I live in fear of one day having to make a choice where I don't have flexibility. Pay my premiums or pay for a car repair. Pay my premiums or go to my grandmother's funeral. Pay my premiums or fix my furnace. House File 3419 would give us breathing room when the choice has no flexibility. It would mean that the fear of the unexpected causing a loss of services and supports would no longer be a part of disability life. It would mean that I can be with my family when my grandmother passes, that I would not need to worry about going without transportation or heat. These changes will not make MAEPD perfect, but it will offer us some relief and reduce some of the perpetual worry that comes with being disabled. It will be the start of lifting ourselves out of the forced poverty of the disability system. This is the step we can take this session to do better by the people who depend on MAEPD. And as we learn from Paul Wellstone, we all do better when we all do better. Thank you for your time and your support of House File 3419.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next on the list of testifiers, I have Bobby Brown. Bobby Brown would like to come forward. Good afternoon. Thank you for coming to the committee today. Please introduce yourself and start your testimony.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair and members, for this opportunity to speak in front of you on this matter. This is a very important matter to me and the survival of me, not only myself, but my family. I brought my daughter and my wife with me just to support me. Just a brief history of who I am. My name is Bobby Brown. I am born and raised in Minneapolis. I was raised by a single parent mother who raised three children on her own through life circumstances, unseen circumstances. I was a victim of a drive-by shooting when I was 15 years old. My mother was able to really support me along with my family through all of my needs as far as medical. I was an MA, straight MA, when I first started with my injury. I had goals that I really wanted to achieve. My mother made sure that I stayed focused on those goals. Some of those goals were to receive an education. and to provide for myself and achieve a dream that with such a disability may be very limited. But I was able to do those things. I did go to college. I did get my degree in business administration. I went on and got my master's degree in psychology. And when it came time to work, the fear that I would not be able to afford my medical was more damaging than anything that I've experienced. I was not aware of the MAEPD program at the time, and when I found out that I could actually work and achieve the dreams that I had set out and to be a contributing member of the society that my mom has always prided herself in to raising a child who could be an upstanding citizen, I thought this was the best thing ever. And then I started making money, and adulting happens, right? Bills, right? And my premium, every time that I would achieve a promotion, my premium would go up. There is this unknown tax that people aren't aware of that I deal with, whether it is with my car breaking down, which my car is currently in shambles right now, that I have to make these decisions whether I do get my car fixed so I can continue to achieve the goals that I set out to be, a good father, a provider for my family. This bill is extremely important to those who are like me, who really do have goals and want to accomplish life outside of these limitations that were placed on us without regard. I really encourage you all to support this bill. It will not only ensure that I can continue to be a contributing factor into our society, but also that my daughter can grow up in a healthy environment. I appreciate you all. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown, for sharing your experiences and being coming forward and sharing with us. It was powerful testimony. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, I have Mr. Trevor Turner, if you'd like to come forward. Welcome to the committee. Welcome. If you'd like to introduce yourself and then start your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and members of the Human Services Policy Committee. My name is Trevor Turner, and I am the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council on Disability. And today I'm here to advocate for House File 3419, which seeks to ensure the continuity of health care services for Minnesotans with disabilities, utilizing the Medical Assistance for Employed People with Disabilities program, even if they can't afford their costly premiums. MAEPD is a lifeline for Minnesotans with disabilities who are striving to maintain employment and independence while ensuring that they have uninterrupted access to health care and disability services that allow them to live and work in the communities of their choice. However, the imposition of costly premiums creates an unnecessary financial burden that undermines the very purpose of this program, which is to allow Minnesotans with disabilities to continue to utilize MA benefits while pursuing their career entrepreneurial dreams. First, let us acknowledge that the individual with disabilities already face numerous challenges in the workforce, from navigating workplace accommodation to overcoming societal barriers. Adding financial strain through premiums only exacerbate those challenges and making it even more difficult for individuals to remain employed and financially stable. When premiums are too high, Minnesotans with disabilities can often find themselves foregoing career or financial goals in order to maintain the critical disability services and health care they need to live. Premiums contradict the fundamental principle of equality and access to health care. Health care is a human right, not a privilege, reserved for those who can afford it. Minnesotans with disabilities already pay for those more than average Minnesotans for health care. And by requiring premiums for MAEPD, we are effectively erecting barriers to health care access based on financial means, which is unacceptable in an ideal, just, and equitable society. Moreover, the imposition of premiums can lead to adverse health outcomes. When individuals are forced to choose between paying premiums or covering essential expenses such as rent, utilities, or medications, their health inevitably suffers. And preventative care is often neglected, leading to more serious health complications down the line and potentially increasing overall health care costs. Eliminating premiums for MAEPD would not only alleviate financial burdens for individuals with disabilities, but also promote workforce participation and independence. It would send a powerful message to our society that values the contributions of Minnesotans with disabilities and is committed to ensuring their health and well-being. So in conclusion, I urge members of this committee to support House File 3419 to prioritize the elimination of premiums for individuals utilizing MAEPD program. By doing so, we reaffirm our commitment to justice, equality, and the fundamental right to health care for all, especially for Minnesotans with disabilities. Thank you, and I can stand here for questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And then the next person I have is Tabiso Rowan. If you'd like to please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for taking the time to be here. Please introduce yourself and then begin your testimony.
Hello, my name is, thank you, committee. My name is Tabiso James Rowan. And I'm just here to kind of reiterate some of what's been said and to just express myself as a member of a community where we are greatly impacted by some of the policy that's behind MAEPD and medical assistance in general, but specifically in this case, MAEPD. So my name is Tabiso Rowan. I grew up here. I was born and raised in St. Paul, home sweet home. And I had a spinal cord injury in 2011. I used to go climb the trees down by Hidden Falls over on the at the Mississippi River here in St. Paul. And I had a spinal cord injury. I accidentally fell from a tree in 2011. And because of that, I was able to go back to school, get a degree in human services with an emphasis in disability, and really understand what it means to be a person with a disability and to live in a world as a person with a disability. I am currently the community engagement specialist at Disability Hub MN. It's a statewide resource network for people with disabilities. And I went to school and I worked hard to have the position that I have, but some of the barriers that I do have are surrounded around this idea that having access to healthcare is a human right. And so just basically to kind of get on with my testimony here, when my income goes up, my premiums go up, of course, with MAEPD. So I'm cautious about making more money or advancing in my career because at the same point I can't afford my premiums. And so just so you know, a little personal information, but I have a suprapubic catheter, kind of like a permanent catheter. I use a colostomy bag. I have other medical needs that a lot of people my age don't have. I need medical supplies just to go to the bathroom, and so MAEPD helps to subsidize some of the costs that I have for my medical supplies. In this case, my bathroom supplies. I have to pay Medicare premiums as well, so this is just tied into this world of paying premiums and having healthcare coverage. And so in order to qualify for MAEPD, this is just to qualify for MAEPD, I have to pay Medicare premiums. So when I had my spinal cord injury, I started receiving SSI, Social Security income. And so I was receiving that as I was recovering, and then I was put onto Medicare. And so now, For another 5.5 years or so because of that Medicare policy, I have to pay Medicare premiums, which is okay, but I don't get any Social Security disability benefits, so it's kind of odd that I'm subject to, be tied into this policy that doesn't necessarily affect me, I guess. But it is money out of my pocket. So a little bit more about myself. I've had pressure sores since I first had my spinal cord injury. I'm a pretty skinny, bony guy, So I've had surgeries, and I've had to stay in hospital for weeks, actually, at a time. And if I can't work, then I lose my MAEPD. So that's why it's so important for me to have some kind of reinsurance that if I can't work, that I won't lose my health care coverage. Somehow it's, you know, this isn't, this program isn't an incentive for me to work, but it also, if I'm not working, it affects how I can live my life. It's kind of like a weird catch-22. And so, you know, I do appreciate having healthcare coverage. It's, like I said, it has been at times difficult to maintain. You know, at one point I did have an overdue premium because I couldn't afford it. And so it was amazing how quickly it worked, but my Medicare was cut. And when I reapplied, the Medicare office lost my application, that which my parents had hand-delivered to the Social Security office. And so because I lost my Medicare, I ended up losing my MAEPD, and then I had to have Senator Klobuchar's office contact the St. Paul Social Security office, and then they got it reinstated. But, you know, it took a lot of time and effort just to get that back. And so I had to pay out of pocket for my medical supplies, you know, just to use the bathroom, like I said, you know, which really hurt me financially and basically made my life a living hell. And so just wanted to, you know, reiterate once again here at the end that some of us have additional needs in life, including, you know, children or people with additional needs, senior citizens and people with disabilities. You know, so why should I be subject to barriers because of the circumstances that the universe and God handed me? You know, in my eyes, a person with a disability, and as a person who has worked professionally with people for disabilities for over a decade, you know, it is criminal to see the injustices that our laws allow towards people with disabilities. And so that's one reason why I'm here to support this bill. And thank you for letting me take your time.
You're welcome. Thank you for taking the time to be here, Mr. Ron. Appreciate it. And then I also have one other testifier that has signed up, Mr. Mark Hughes. If you'd like to come forward, please.
Hi, I'm Mark Hughes, Chair Fisher, members of the committee. Thank you for this time. I'll be as brief as I can. You know, you kind of plan on your way in the mornings what you're going to testify and what you're going to say, but my whole script has changed because it's been interesting. First of all, Julian stops me in the hall while we're waiting to get in here and says that we need to bring TEFRA back to get these premiums a little more under control. Then you hear a testimony in here that I could have gone to my grandma's funeral, but my premiums, my medical premiums were due. My car needs fixing, but my medical premiums were due. But the important part is that in good economic times, we're still 78 to 80% disability people unemployed. This MAEPD for persons with disabilities employment is very important. I'm sure that if I can call, use Jeff Bangsberg's name for a minute, that when we started out, there was a guy named Jim Ramstead that started the Ticket to Work program. And I think we need to update that. I think that we need to take a look at it, because I was thinking of Jim today that he would never hear excuses that we're not paying our medical premium and we can't afford to work or to be so. Can't take a promotion because it'd make his medical premiums higher. That's not fair. What is fair is that we're working and we all have the same equal opportunity. This isn't an equal opportunity in my estimation. And I've been around here a long time and I'm not going to retire. Some people wish I would, but I probably won't. And I just feel that this is important. We need to bring back the TEFRA for one thing. And we need to take a look at Jim Ramstead's Ticket to Work program to see how we can update and keep this employment for people with disabilities going in the fashion that people can get their cars fixed, they can pay their medical premium, they can go to grandma's funeral. All these things that aren't happening now need to happen. And remember, if one individual does better, we're all going to do better. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for your testimony, Mr. Hughes. All right, is there any further testimonies, testifiers that would like to address the committee? Hearing none, I've got a list of folks who have got questions already, starting with Representative Coran.
Thank you, Chair. And my question is for Representative Hicks. If I understand correctly, so if someone is on the MEPD program, they're paying a premium of a minimum of $35 a month. And as I understand it, then if they're unable to pay that fee, that cuts off their all of their medical assistance. I'm seeing a nod yes. And so I just want to sort of ground us in what this could mean for a wide range of people. Because this affects people of varying abilities and skill levels, people with a variety of support services and living arrangements. And so, you know, that can range from living independently to living in a community-based residential setting. And so I just, from what I've seen in my experience doing 10 years of billing for that type of provider, in cases, this means that those providers aren't able to bill for their service. And so they've got an individual who's working and they are living in a group home setting and their daily rate of a few hundred dollars a day and up, depends on their needs, that gets cut off. And to a small provider, the longer that process takes for that person to get back on the program, the longer that provider suffers and potentially may not be able to make payroll. And that's how we start to see smaller providers start to tumble. So I just want to advocate, you know, that this has a wide-ranging effect that shall cut people off of services does not just mean that they're losing the ability to be on MAEPD. It means that if they're on a waiver service and they're living in a group home, they lose all of their services. And when you call and say, hey, we really need your help to speed this up, we're now serving this person and we're not getting paid for it, what do we do? The answer is, well, it is your option to kick them out because you're not getting paid. That's not an option. That is absolutely never an option. And I think this bill protects people where we can ensure that providers are going to be able to provide that stable environment for the person, and we're not having, we're not having conversations over finances about whether somebody loses their home. And so I wanted to highlight that this is not only the right thing to do, it's the responsible thing to do. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Representative Curran. Next, I have Representative Pinky.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. Thank you to all of our testifiers. I just wanted to acknowledge your the grace with which you come and share your stories here today, and call out one other institutional structural disadvantage that we have set up to the world of our neighbors who live with disabilities, is that they have to come here all the time and ask us to do basic quality of life equitable things, even things like this, which I thought we solved this problem, and they're back. They keep coming back for the same problems that we could just decide to be the kind of society that says everybody should have equal access. We should have an equitable system that works for everyone, and then we can let people just go live their lives instead of constantly having to come back here. So I just want to thank you again, and I really did think that we had done this. And so thank you for coming back and making sure we get it done this time.
Thank you, Representative Pinky. Next, I have Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hicks, for bringing this bill forward. Last year, we were too close to making the premium for MAPD. Very close. However, we took care of the asset limit that was set in the MAPD program. That was a huge achievement, as we did that, you know, during the budget setting. However, we don't want to go back to TEFRA. Not at all. We eliminated TEFRA, and that's a good thing. And this bill actually addresses structural systemic issues, whereby if you don't pay the premiums, that you'll be terminated and you will lose your coverage. However, we want to copy some of the components that were created under TEFRA, where individuals can continue to receive their medical assistance program if they're unable to pay and we can do the revenue recapture in case an individual doesn't pay. I don't like revenue recapture, but at least we have the alternative for making sure individuals stay on their coverage. So with this bill, I think we need to start addressing it, and I'm hoping the next round we will be able to eliminate the MA EPD premiums completely. So that's the promise that we are making to individuals with disabilities. We see you, we hear you, we value you. So thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Knorr. Next, I've got Representative Edelson and then Keel, and then we've also got two more bills yet today. So Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be quick. I mean, my colleagues have said a lot. I just, for those of you that are not paying, there's a calculator on the online that I found, because there is a lot of similarities between this and TEFRA, and I would agree with my colleague, Representative Knorr, we do not want to go back to TEFRA fees, because that was also not good. But I love your solution on this, at least for right now, until, because I'll admit, what you really want to happen is to your testifiers. So your stories are really helpful. Thank you for being here. What you want them to have is that continuum of care where it's not interrupted by this, and that they're automatically enrolled into a different program that won't stop care. So I'm really appreciative of the approach here. And at least if it's something where we don't know how much money we're going to have this year, I think this is something that's really realistic. Because unfortunately, I agree with you, Representative Finke, we can't fix all the problems because we don't have always enough money. And that's one of the frustrations of being in this room. It is really hard. It is really hard. So thank you for this solution.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, Representative Hicks, is there a fiscal note on this yet, or have you requested one?
Yes, one has been requested. We don't have one yet, but as we work with the department to get that fiscal note, I really want to highlight that there's been a lot of talk about TEFRA today, and I think that's because this is how we always did it for parents of kids with disabilities. So if your child had a disability, we didn't factor that into the forecast. We just assumed we'd get it from you eventually, and we let your kid keep getting services. But for an adult, we just turn off all of their health care. And so this, as we work with the department to identify that fiscal, that will be kind of the driving force, is that we're not looking at expanding the program. We're not looking at, right, we're literally looking at how many people have lost their health care and how much was that $400 premium and how many would that be in the next year.
That's the fiscal note.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we need to move on, but I have to say something. I was looking at the department's information, and I see that it says that if you qualify and have paid your premium, because you have not paid the premium, the next one, you will not lose your services. And I found that interesting because we're having this conversation about people who are dropped off. And certainly we want people to have care. On the other hand, if the department is telling people that they won't lose their services, what am I missing?
So I think I think what you're looking at is if people lose their jobs, there is a little bit of a grace period that occurs. It can be up to 90 days. And I would ask the department, I'm looking to see if Ann's here, to come and further explain some of those pieces. But, and I can't explain some of those details. I'll ask Ann to come down. But I can tell you, as a disability advocate for 10 years, and the stories these people are telling you is not untrue. People are getting kicked off their health care. It happens all the time. There's usually a little bit of a grace, but if you require support to get out of bed in the morning, and if that person can't get paid and they don't show up, you don't go to work.
Mm-hmm.
So, and after 10 years of doing disability advocacy, I know people are getting kicked off because I helped them reapply. Okay, so I'll let Ann answer
very quickly. I'll have, if you'd like to introduce yourself, and then very quick answer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Ann Bops with the Department of Human Services, and thank you for the question, Representative Keel. Representative Hicks is correct. We do have some options in place when a person is unable to pay their premium for things like losing a job. We do also have a good cause process where if, you know, something unexpected comes up, a person can have a premium or multiple premiums forgiven if they apply for that good cause process. So there are some things in place, but generally, yes, if a person does not pay their premium, they do end up losing their coverage for non-payment of premium.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I noticed the good cause. I'm a little confused about, I mean, I'm not disagreeing that Representative Hicks, that people lose their coverage. I'm just wondering, do people understand that they can apply for a good cause and request it? Well, that's what it says in the department site.
No. They.
Representative Hicks.
They absolutely can. But I think there's a couple of pieces to this. The first part is, yes, there are options sometimes. The second part is you have to, one, know how to do that, right? And my next bill up is about how complicated the system is. So we can talk about why people don't know how to do that in just a second. You have to know how to do that. And then you have to be able to do it. And then you have to be able to do it fast enough and get the response fast enough to actually make that efficient. Because like Representative Curran said, providers stop getting paid. And so it doesn't matter if I call and say, no, trust me, it's going to be turned back on. I'm working on it. I've put in the request. If they're not getting paid, they're not sending a staff to my house to get me out of bed. Those things don't happen. The other piece that I think is really important to kind of be mindful of in this space is that we're asking folks who already have paperwork upon paperwork upon paperwork upon thing upon ping upon thing to do yet to somehow know about the thing, do the thing, and do the thing fast enough and get the various governmental agencies responsible for doing the thing done fast enough to make sure that somebody can come and get them up so they can go to the bathroom in the morning. Over and over and over and over again. And when they lose a job and their income drops and they're no longer eligible for MA, a lot of times what you're seeing on the department's website is that there is coverage available. That coverage that's available is an MA with a spend down. So if you lose your job and now you're on MA because you lost your job, you might have health care, but you're going to spend down for it. And if you're married and you have kids, it gets even more complicated. If you're not working at all, it gets more complicated. If you're like our one testifier who's worked off of Social Security, exactly what we tell everybody we want them to do, but is federally required to continue to pay Medicare, it gets even more complicated. Because now we got to go back into the federal system. Mm-hmm. So all I'm asking is that we maybe give people a minute to breathe. Just give them a minute to breathe. And I know my community, and I know my community will pay. They're just asking for a minute to breathe.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Thank you, Representative Hicks. We'll move on. Seeing Representative Hicks, would you like to make any closing comments or renew your motion?
No, I'll just renew it. I'm good.
Okay, Representative Hicks renews her motion that House File 3419 be referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails and the bill is referred to Human Services Finance. Next item on the agenda is House File 3445, another Representative Hicks bill. Representative Hicks, would you like to move your bill?
I would like to refer House File 3445 to the Human Services Finance Committee.
Representative Hicks moves to refer House File 3445 to the Human Services Finance Committee. Representative Hicks, if you'd like to explain your bill, and I will let folks know that we've got about 15 minutes here because we've got one more bill to do. And so I'm also going to ask that the testifiers stay to about a minute and a half on their testimony. Representative Hicks, go ahead.
Thank you so much. So this bill is a continuous improvement study. The process for accessing disability services is very difficult. It's not working the way it's supposed to work, but it is working 87 different ways. And the process of this bill is to take a look, to ask the department to hire a contractor to take a look at what should happen. So anybody who's done continuous improvement knows the way you start about what you're doing is you identify what's supposed to be happening, right? And then work with people experiencing the system to go through a almost like a journey mapping to identify what actually happened and figure out where the disconnects are and bring a report back to the department and to us to help us make informed solutions about how to make it better. I have a lot of ideas about how to make it better. I think the department has a lot of ideas about how to make it better. I know our county partners have ideas about how to make it better. And people experiencing the services have ideas about how to make it better. But we aren't going to come up with solutions that are going to work for everyone until we identify where the problems are. And so this is an attempt to do that with some one-time funding. We may be in a slightly different position once we get over to Human Services Finance. But I think we're not going to make this better unless we at least start having the conversation. So. This is my bill.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. First person we have is Ms. Jillian Nelson. If you'd like to introduce yourself, start your testimony. You got about a minute and a half.
Good afternoon, Chair Fisher and committee members. I am still Jillian Nelson. I could spend an entire hearing telling you about the unnecessary appeals, the three-month argument over a request for an accessibility tool in an already approved waiver goal, or the complicated and time-consuming paperwork process that seems to always result in being told I missed something, even if I did it the exact same way I did it every single time. Last year, Representative Hicks and I came to you asking for an accessibility task force to look at the challenges of this system. We heard hesitations and concerns about the vastness of the work to be done, but we also believe in the necessity of improving the experience people with disabilities face when working within the system for life-sustaining supports. We knew in our heart of hearts that this work had to be centered on the lived experience of the community and the very massive obstacles faced daily, and not the perceived process that is laid out by administrators. And this is how the Continuous Improvement Project was born. When administrators think about reform, they think about how to make the system work better for them. But what we need is to make this system easier for the people who navigate the services. The Continuous Improvement Project will tie in the reality of what is happening for people navigating this system compared to what should be happening. And when we understand where the disconnects are happening, we can repair the problems with more than theory or reimagining, and we can apply real experience to create real change. Thank you for supporting House File 3445.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson. Great job on your timing there. Next, I have Mr. Trevor Turner.
Go ahead and welcome to the committee. Go ahead and introduce yourself, who you're with, and please start your testimony.
Thanks again, Chair Fisher, and thanks again, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Trevor Turner. I'm the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council on Disability, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Council on Disability to support House File 3445 and to emphasize the critical need for Minnesota state agencies to prioritize accessibility and clarity in disability services. As a state agency deeply invested in disability rights advocacy, the Minnesota Council on Disability witnesses the struggles Minnesotans with disabilities face when trying to access essential services within our state. Navigating the maze of disability services can feel like an insurmountable challenge for many individuals and families. The complexity of the process often leads to confusion, frustration, and unnecessary delays in receiving crucial services and supports. It's imperative that Minnesota's state government take responsibility for ensuring that these services are accessible and easily understood by all those who need them. Accessibility encompasses more than physical accommodations. It also includes the ease of which individuals can navigate the bureaucratic process involved in accessing services. Many individuals with disabilities face barriers such as inaccessible websites, complex forms, and a lack of clear communication about available services. These barriers not only hinder access, but also perpetuate inequality and exclusion. As stewards of public resources, Minnesota state agencies have a duty to streamline and simplify the application process for disability services. This includes investing in accessible online platforms, providing plain language guidance on eligibility criteria and available services, and offering assistance throughout the application process. It's not enough to educate the public on how to access these services, but to proactively audit these processes and ask ourselves, how can we reduce the bureaucratic red tape and ensure that everyone who qualifies for services actually receives them?
Mr. Turner, if you could wrap it up.
Absolutely. So I urge the committee to recognize the responsibility of Minnesota state government in making disability services more accessible and understandable. By prioritizing accessibility and clarity, we can create a more inclusive and equitable system that holds the rights and dignity of all individuals with disabilities in our state. I would like to thank Representative Hicks for advocating for this bill, and I urge members of the committee to support House File 3445. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, I have Mylena Bates. Yes, Bates, if you could please come forward, introduce yourself, and begin your testimony, and we are kind of limited on time. So,
okay.
Thank you.
I actually only have one page. This is just an extra copy, so no worries about
that. Okay, great. Thank you.
It's Mylena Bates, and I forgive your accent. No problem.
Thank you.
Chair Fisher and committee members, I'm going to skip my introduction and just say that my perspective here is that all the different identities that help me understand why this is desperately needed is I'm a parent of children with disabilities. I've provided disability supports professionally. I'm a volunteer organizer in the community and mentor, and I'm also a person with disabilities. So I just want to demonstrate, just so you know, because you're making me go fast, I'm not going to say something funny that I was going to say. So, you know, that's your loss, but okay. So I have no issues with reading comprehensions. I read for pleasure as well as to learn things. And but unfortunately, when I have to do county and state forms, I'm bewildered and sometimes cry with frustrations. I'm not afraid to admit that. And I used to think that I was alone in that. But then I was in a really large town hall with a lot of other people, and I've learned that I'm in very large and very good company. And also in the last few years, I've learned so much about accessibility through various programs. And I learned that it's so much more than ADA compliance. It's things like a dyslexic person needs to be able to receive printed materials in a dyslexic-friendly font or an audio format. Hmm. That is not a huge ask, and it's basic accessibility. Plain language is accessibility for a lot of different areas of disability. None of those things exist in the process of accessing disability services. And if there's one process that should be accessible, that should be accessing disability services, right? And so this is actually not only absurd, it's actually causing people to not be able to work and thrive. And it's causing people to need more intensive interventions. And as we've heard in the town hall, sometimes they even die because of a lack of access to the basic services. So that's just a glimpse from my perspective of why this is desperately needed. Thank you, Representative Hicks, for caring. And thank you all for listening.
Thank you, Ms. Bates, for taking the time to be here. Next, I have Fatima Molas. If you'd like to come forward, please. Thank you for taking the time to come to visit with us today. If you'd like to introduce yourself, and then please start your testimony.
Thank you for welcoming me here today, Chair Fisher and committee members. My name is Fatima Moss. I'm a parent of a child with a disability. I'm also a member of the Somali community and the co-founder of Multicultural Autism Action Network, MAN. I'm here today to tell you that any system that relies on social capital for access is discriminatory. Our current systems of support for people with disabilities discriminates against people who do not speak English as their first language. Our disability support systems discriminate against people whose preferred method of communication is oral rather than written. It discriminates against people from communities where the stigma against disability is so strong that they are afraid to talk about their loved ones' disability and needs for the fear of being ostracized by the community. We have seen the devastating effects when families are not supported. Families in our communities are barely hanging by a thread. And right now, it feels like no one is paying attention. That's why I'm asking you to support House File 3445. Because when we cannot solve problems, we cannot see. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Molas, for your testimony and taking the time to be here today. Then next testifier is Jonathan Murray. If you'd like to please come forward.
My daughter, Juliet, would like to say one word.
Certainly. Yes, Julia, please come forward. Hi, Julia.
Juliet, go.
Welcome.
Please support people with disabilities.
Thank you, Julia. Thank you for being here today. If you'd like to introduce yourself, please, and begin your testimony.
Chair Fisher, committee members, I'm Jonathan Murray. I'm the
co-chair of the Anti-Racism, Intersectionality, and Inclusion Committee over at the Minnesota Consortium of Citizens with Disabilities. Like Jillian, I could have filled a whole committee meeting on this topic. Unfortunately, we only have a couple minutes. I'm here as a client with of disability service providers, a person with autism and other disabilities and comorbidities who is reliant on waiver services to supplement the capacity of that disability tax lost to my disability, and as an expert designing in for disabled populations. And I'm in support of this bill. Through the CDCS system, I'm being asked to run a small business and coordinate my care. But by statute, I have four layers of bureaucracy that are entitled to interfere and deny items I budget for. In the meantime, I'm the person with the least access to my files running a business and least access to the reporting and accounting information. I don't know if how many of you are also business owners, but like that's a hard place to be. Mm-hmm. Community-directed supports and its successor community-first supports exist with the specific goal of creating supports that work with people with disabilities, not against us. But this is really not being put into place. I would strongly recommend, like, some of the things I think this bill will find are what we can do with proactive government that fits people, that things that can be automatic. One of the specific things that I think can be identified by this bill is reactivating the script team built by Veronica Carey back in 2014, when they built the equivalent of autocorrect for case management that was deployed statewide to catch errors in case and data entry. The Inoko Board of Commissioners Chair Rwanda Sivajara, who also chaired the Human Services Committee, said it saved hundreds of hours of work time each month and reduced errors and prompted standardization within DHS. That project continues in a couple of partner communities, but however, DHS and Minute didn't fund and make it sustainable, so it was discontinued.
Thank you, Mr. Ed. Can you give a closing sentence, please?
Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be here. Are there any further testifiers that would like to address the committee? Hearing none, Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just really quick. I would, Representative Hicks, I think it's a great bill. I would just maybe recommend that you request some things back from the to the legislature back in like the session of 2025. I have done many studies, and I will tell you from experience, not all of them, if there's 15 recommendations, 5 will be taken. So I think coming back with a few things, I think a lot of us know some things that really need fixed. So just that's my only feedback. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Edelson. Representative Hicks, do you have any closing comments?
I would just say one quick thing, and then I know we're out of time today, but I would assume all of you in this room, if you've spent any time with me, know that I know the system very, very well. I can't access services for my own child without supports. Me. I have to ask for help because I still can't get things off the ground. So if that doesn't say that it's broken, I don't know what else does. So thank you so much.
With that, Representative Hicks renews her motion to have House File 3445 referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails, and the bill is referred to House Services Human Services Finance. And with that, our final bill is a bill that I have, House File 3533, and I will be handing the gavel over to Vice Chair Frederick.
Thank you.
Once again, situated, Chair Fisher, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would like to refer House File 3533 to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee.
Please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, thank you for the opportunity to present House File 3533. This is a bill that does several things. It helps establish to formalize a process that makes it easier for counties to put together a health care system that allows them to administer the Medicaid program to their local citizens. Right now, it's a very complicated process for the counties to come together. We've had some counties that have done a great job in being able to do that. We've had Prime West as an example, South Country Healthcare, and then Itasca all have their own networks. But it becomes sometimes a lawsuit to try to get these things established. And so what this bill is to do is to bring the Department of Human Services together with the counties to make sure that we can make the process easier than it has been. I do know that this is something that Department of Human Services is very interested. They've been working with the counties to make this happen. And what this bill does is allow us to set up a process that will come back with the recommendations for what this model should look like in the future. And what gets me very excited about this, I see this taking our healthcare system to the next level. So often over the years, one of the things I've seen by working in the homeless youth community is so often that we see people come out of the healthcare system and they've got nowhere else to go, they become homeless or they don't have the supports there, and all of a sudden the care that for those of us who are stably housed comes to us, the care very easily, making sure we've got our medications, etc., does not flow the same way if you don't have the stable services wrapped around. And what I've been really impressed by with the counties that have done this, they've actually gone to the next level where they've wrapped their social service workers right into it. So it becomes a seamless operation. So as people are coming out, if it's a problem with not having transportation, they're able to wrap it in. If they're housing insecure, if they've got food insecurity, they're able to wrap all these things in a way that our managed care organizations cannot. And I think this is the next level of what our future is going to be. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to our testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First up to testify will be Steve Gottwald. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Steve Gottwald. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Association of County Health Plans. Now, this is the Association of Minnesota's three county-based purchasing plans that are owned and operated by the counties they serve. It's a very important distinction about this particular model. We care for about 90,000 public program enrollees across 33 counties of greater Minnesota. I want to thank Chair Fisher for his leadership in bringing forward this legislation that seeks to build on the more than 40 years of success with county-based health plans in greater Minnesota. These county-owned and operated plans, contracting and working with our Department of Human Services, offer a locally focused, county-based model of care delivery, integrating with other county services, as Representative Fisher mentioned, and partnering with rural care providers and supporting their local communities. County-based purchasing was written into state law by a bipartisan coalition of legislators in 1997. Now, as many of you know, for the last several years, we have encountered some legal conflicts with the Department of Human Services over what the state's CBP laws currently say about county-based authority and public programs. But that has not prevented us, and this is what's kind of exciting about this, it has not stopped us from also discussing how we can do better together for the people we serve. I want to commend DHS Commissioner Harpstead for her foresight and leadership and thank the entire DHS team. We have been meeting monthly for almost a year to discuss areas of potential alignment and improvement as we look at a better and stronger county-based model. In 2022, following a round of mediation on procurement, Commissioner Harpstead implemented procurement results with a court order, which is normal. But she took an extra step. She voluntarily included a recommendation endorsed by all three mediators on the panel, urging us to look ahead and to work on a new and improved county-based model, County-Administered Rural Medical Assistance, or CARMA. The bill before you seeks legislative direction and authorization, and it requires the commissioner to work collaboratively with counties during the interim to develop details of this CARMA model, and then bring that back as a recommendation to the legislature in 2025, including a detailed implementation plan and model legislation. HF 3533 is not only an opportunity to move past legal disputes over current state law and facilitate greater alignment and collaboration between DHS and counties, it is more importantly an opportunity for us to innovate together toward an improved and strengthened county-based model that would further integrate county health and social services, again, as Representative Fisher mentioned, to address social determinants of health, a huge goal in health care reform. We appreciate your time and consideration. I'd be glad to answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Gottwald. Next up will be Brad Anderson, and after that, Matt Freeman. Mr. Anderson, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Brad Anderson, Goodyear County Commissioner. You sure you don't want to come over to the commissioner's side?
Pretty sure.
You make a really good argument.
Thank you.
Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address this bill. I'm Brad Anderson. In my 10th year as a Goodyear County Commissioner and in my 10th year at South Country Health Alliance Board as a board member, I also serve on the Finance Committee, the Quality Assurance Committee, the Utilization Management Committee at South Country. To say county commissioners are passionate about this work is an understatement. I want to touch on 3 points related to this bill. First, why counties, why this bill now? Rural health outcomes require unique approaches to address the social determinants of health. It requires integration of the health plan with the county public health and human services programs. This collaborative, coordinated, and integrated work between the groups of counties and the health plan ensure all needs for an enrollee are addressed, whether that is access to local providers, which we as a county health plans work with, or addressing housing, food security, transportation, or any of the 40 to 50 programs the county delivers for state and federal departments. Yes, we are interested in investing in our citizens in many ways. We have been doing this work for 40 years at the county level, and yes, we care. That's why we're here. We strive for a person-centered continuum of care, and the integration with the health plan is a large part of that work. Second, litigation. I have done it. I don't want to continue to be in the position to have to choose it again. It is not fun and not the way our citizens want government to work. I am convinced no one truly wins in litigation, and it's a waste of valuable resources. Let's address the issues and move forward. Thirdly, finally, this bill is outcome-driven with the right people at the table. The bill is looking at opportunities for better outcomes, not focusing on barriers. I applaud the recent mediation team for initiating a framework to build on, and Commissioner Harpstead for supporting this endeavor. We have individual counties, groups of counties, AMC, and DHS all working to move this forward. Beyond that group, CMS will be involved as we collectively and collaboratively work on this initiative. The counties, state departments, state legislature, and federal agencies working collaboratively is what your constituents and our county citizens want on this issue and many other important issues. We got this, and I'm confident this will yield positive results and build a better path forward. So after a year of meeting, we are here looking to you as leaders to support the efforts to take this to the next level and build for the future of rural health care. Please support this bill, initiating and embracing a collaboration of our units of government. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Next up will be Matt Freeman. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Frederick, Chair Fisher, Committee, Matt Freeman. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators and the Human Service Policy Analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'm here today to thank you for allowing me to speak on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties in support of all 87 counties backing House File 3533, the county-administered Rural Medical Assistance Development Bill. As you've heard from the other testifiers, this is a year-long process of collaboration already between AMC and the three county-based purchasing plans in cooperation with the Department of Human Services. AMC and our county commissioners who manage these plans are excited about this work with DHS, and we're hopeful that the final product will highlight and build on the successes of CPPs. AMC and our commissioners know the importance of local county-based care delivery and integration with other county services. It makes for great care and outstanding outcomes for the people that we serve. AMC is excited about this opportunity to do this even better, and this bill offers the opportunity to collaboratively flesh out the details of a new and improved county-based model, CARMA. Thanks for your consideration and your support.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. At this point, we will turn it over to member questions. First up is Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. I feel like I'm talking a lot today. I just want to say thank you. Thank you. Chair Fisher knows that I believe in this model. And Southwest West Goodhue, nice job, because their services are extraordinary for the people that they support. The idea that people can get the right care at the right time from the right people is phenomenal. And I am so excited to see this kind of coming to fruition. And I can't wait to see where it goes. Thank you, Chair.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Fisher, just a quick question in relation to the program. As we're looking at the 1115 waiver for the health-related social needs, where will this program intersect with that change?
Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Noor. A lot of that is to determine what's going to, that's what this bill is supposed to do, is help figure out those kind of questions. We have not purposely outlined anything in here. It's leaving it wide open so that the counties and the state can have full discussion to see what makes sense as we go forward.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we have a discussion that will be coming up soon to talk about the 1115 waivers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, or Chair Fisher, can you tell me, this looks really good. I wonder how this would affect managed care organizations so that our counties, especially our smaller counties, have the option of both this service but also managed care.
Chair Fisher.
Thank you for that question. I might call up a friend to help on that. Once again, I think it's one of those things that as they're putting the model together, they would take a look at. But I know where we have the county managed care organizations right now, they basically run in those areas. But I'll turn that over to my testifier to make sure I'm not missing something there.
So I will also just say, members, that we do have a couple minutes extra that we can go over that we've been cleared for. So, Mr. Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Keel, thank you for the question. So this question comes up all the time about choice and competition. And as many of you know, metro areas have many distinct health systems that compete with each other on cost, on quality, on choice of providers or clinics, on choice of hospitals. When you get out to greater Minnesota, where we're talking about this model operating, you don't have distinct health systems competing with each other. You have one clinic, one hospital, one dental provider, one behavioral health provider. And what we've been doing is, under the guise of competition or choice, we've been basically putting a different wrapper on the exact same product. That's not real competition. Counties are always at the end of the chain, right? When things don't go well, the counties pick up the slack. And that is really why county-based purchasing was formed in the first place. But the simple answer is, if somebody doesn't like a county plan that they're working with, they can always default to DHS fee-for-service. There is that choice. Counties don't have to do this either. I mean, this is a choice that counties make, and they make a substantial investment of time, talent, and treasure to make a county-based model work. So this isn't for every county. It's for counties that choose and think that this is the right way to do it. And where we have small populations, small numbers of people in these various programs, it does a very efficient and effective job of getting them the care they need in a manner that is very locally responsive and accountable. So there is choice. I mean, if somebody really had a problem, they would have a choice. But choice gets used, I think, a little differently when we're talking rural.
And if I could, thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things I'd like to add on there is, one of the things that the counties are very good at is they know the local providers and what's happening in the area, and they're going to be willing to, because of how efficiently they operate, they can pay a little bit better in the reimbursement rate. So we've heard over time, particularly in the health committee, how we've seen pharmacies closing down because they're not getting properly reimbursed by the large insurance companies, because the large insurance companies are driven by what they can do to force the price down.
The county-based model is taking a look, how can we do better for our citizens? And that means not only the person receiving the help, but those that are providing it, making sure that they're being reimbursed for rates that will allow them to continue providing the services in the rural areas. And that's so often what happens in our system, is that they try to treat the large, you know, the small areas like the large areas, and it causes people to lose their services. And the insurance company will say, you know what, there's a hospital 50 miles away, you can go there, instead of putting in the extra money to keep the local hospital going, where your local county is going to be more concerned about making sure that that local hospital keeps being there to provide those critical services, or the local drugstore. And so they're able to take those extra dollars that they've got available and invest those right back into the local community, which is something that the insurance companies really don't have that vested interest in. And this is why I get so excited about, because how it helps support our rural areas and getting the money back into the hands of the local people.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Frederick. Chair Fisher, with that reinforcement, and I would agree with you, I think Mr. Gottwald knows the same thing, that very, very much it's important to protect our rural hospitals and even our pharmacies. You know, it's a little scary sometimes to see what you will or will not have for health care. So with that, I'll certainly be adding my name to the bill. So thank you.
Seeing no further questions, Chair Fisher, closing comments, and would you like to renew your motion?
I just want to say thank you, committee. This is a great bill. Please all support it. And with that, I renew my motion that House File 3533 be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee.
Chair Fisher moves to re-refer House File 3533 to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the bill is referred.
Everybody.
Bang. Our next hearing will be on Wednesday, February 21st. We will be considering the recodification bills as well as Chair Fisher's bill on the recodification separating drug care and treatment. We plan to hear the bill from Representative Baker on Wednesday as well. Seeing no further business, we are adjourned.